Turns out the glass ceiling was made of Lexan.
What?
Lexan's like a...
What is Lexan?
It's like a polycarbonate. It's like a... It's like bulletproof material. It's like... The glass... turns out the glass ceiling...
No freaking kidding.
Is bulletproof.
Is yeah.
That, is that better?
Sure. yeah.
It turns out... No, okay. Well, there's no way to salvage that one. Yeah, all right, interesting. All I know is I want Nate Silver's balls as a necklace.
Okay. Why is that?
Because he certainly called this one real good.
To
me, all it proves is that polling is absolutely useless. And every year,
apparently,
or every 4 years, it's just us watching a bunch of news people sit around and go, gee, well, got that one wrong. Yeah,
because
exit polls don't mean anything. Or you're just not asking the right questions.
Well, but when they were asking exit polls, the people who were undecided before were by far more voting for Trump than for Clinton.
Yeah.
Which is pretty upsetting, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think the undecidedness comes from them just not liking either candidate.
Right.
And so when you put a gun to their head or put a ballot to their head, they just go, Trump.
Right.
So anyway, not a political show.
No.
And not planning to talk about that very much, but I mean, you can't get away from it. It's just everywhere.
I can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, you'll get over it.
This is my message to
millennials. Hello. Welcome. We had one of these too. This has already happened to us. So now you're getting a taste of what it's like. And yeah, you'll make it. We made it. Everybody's going to make it. We're all going to make it.
To me, this is much worse than the George W. Bush presidency.
Really?
Far worse.
The fact that we are still at war right now and Guantanamo Bay is still open.
I know that those things still exist.
Not a political show.
But I am worried. What I am worried about is the rights of people that I know and love and care for, and that honestly, that they should have these rights that they are experiencing right now.
Sure.
Or I'm worried about them being taken away.
But
there's
no way to take them away though.
I don't know that.
No.
He has put so much fear into his campaign. And regardless of what he does as a president, how do we move on as a country?
The thing is that, like, you can blame him all you want. He is just somebody who wanted to be president. We made him president. The people made him the president.
I know.
So we focus on getting, really, like, upset. A good candidate, like, getting somebody who not only, you know, is qualified for the job, which... I'm glad that we never have to hear community organizer being thrown as an epithet anymore, because this guy has no qualifications for this job.
Yeah.
Getting somebody who's likable and...
Apparently, that is very, very, very important.
Apparently, that's the only thing.
Yeah.
And so...
It's just a big popularity
contest. But despite all that, like, it doesn't... The president, I think, is just not, or at least should not be as important as we make it. I don't think the president... He's just one guy. You know what I mean? He's just one thing.
I know.
And so it's about... The people who went out and said, let's vote for this guy, either because I like his TV show or I don't like the other person.
Right.
And so we keep thinking, how do we get a better candidate? How do we reveal horrible things about the candidate that's there? When we really need to figure out why these people would want to do this. That's the problem. That's the disease. We're treating the symptoms.
Yes.
And so I think instead of... And there's going to be lots of navel-gazing from both sides, because the Republicans aren't exactly happy about this either.
Right.
We're all going to be, you know, shoegazing and over this, and hopefully we can figure out that we need to think about how to reach people and how to change people's minds and give them what they want, but also give them something and make them want it.
Yes.
You know, like more freedoms for all kinds of people and that sort of thing. Not a political show, though.
No.
No, it is a podcast, not a political one. It's the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Mikan Hanna.
And we're here to bring you all the news that's fit to cast in the world of nerdy entertainment and sometimes political theater.
I will try very hard to be cheerful the rest of the show.
You're
going to
do a great job. I know
that?
You are.
Okay.
But it's something that touches everybody, and it's certainly in the nerd communities where I live... is a big deal. And so, I don't know. It's just on our minds, you know, and it's also current events. So we talk about it. Also, when this is being recorded, it'll be past the date when this show comes out. But it is Bill Mantlo's birthday today.
Oh,
he's 65 years young. Yeah. Bill Mantlo, you must know, I'm sure you know, creator of Rocket Raccoon, Rom, did a lot of work on The Hulk.
Right.
Micronauts, Cloak and Dagger, amongst many, many other creations for Marvel.
How is he doing?
He is not great, and that is why I wanted to bring him up, in addition to wishing him a happy birthday. But he was in an accident a long time ago, like 20 years ago now,
right.
And basically ended his career. He is pretty much, you know, he's unable to work, and he just needs to be supported, basically. He's on long-term care support. And it is a constant drain. I was surprised to learn this. Because you'd think Marvel, Disney, like, they're not paying anybody if they can help it. They were apparently very generous to him over Guardians of the Galaxy.
Good.
Yeah, and all the money that they made over using his characters and situations in that film. And
that's
so
awesome.
They were very kind in compensating him. But his care is ongoing and will be as long as he's around, which is hopefully for a long, long time. And so he always needs money and he always needs help. And so I would encourage our listeners, if you want to help out with his care, you can go and search for it online. There's no particular, like, one place to send you. I guess you could just, you know, you could go to BillMantlow.com. You can search for him on Google and look up supporting him and helping him. I know he has a charity that is run by his brother. And so you could do that. I know that his PayPal address is Mickey's, like Mickey Mouse, sccc@AOL.com. So if you want to just pay him directly through PayPal, like I said, it goes to Michael Mantlow and it goes to keeping Bill healthy and happy. And so do that. I would say before you go to our Patreon page.
Whoa.
Do that. Yes. Well, flip a coin.
What? I was going to say that's
when
very
big of you. When they put a ballot to your head.
Now I'm going
to
take that back.
Whatever you pick, then go with that. I'm not sure if we are more or less likable than Bill Mantlow, but I'd hate to be in that contest.
Yes.
Much less have to judge it.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the show. We are going to talk about a little news today, as we usually do. And it's a special show today. It's Friday, so we're going to do Comic Book Club, as per usual.
Yep.
We're talking about Black Science, which is a comic that I have enjoyed quite a bit and is near and dear to me. And it's by Rick Remender.
Yep.
That gum-chewing fool, spinner of all sorts of things. Interesting personality and an interesting guy. We'll talk about that. We did the first volume, if you want to know. I hope you read it so you can join us. If not, you can always pause this. It's a podcast.
That's right. Come
Go
back.
Go check it out. It's the first six issues of Black Science. Also, I think that we, especially after the events of Tuesday, need to hear from women more in this country.
Absolutely.
We were joking about the glass ceiling
100%
earlier,
I agree with you.
But it's a real deal. It's a real thing. And we have been lining up a series of interviews with creators from the nerd world. And as I was kind of putting these together, I realized these are all women. Now, I think that I am, go with me here, I think that I'm enlightened enough that I was a little worried that it was all women. I thought maybe we should have some men. Because I'm like reverse. I'm so feminist. I'm like, this is too much females. And I thought about it and I thought, screw it. Let's just do it. Let's just run the entire series as writing women, as women from creators from the world of the nerd, because we need to hear that.
Absolutely.
And so on this show today, we're going to hear from Carrie Patel, author of the Recoleta trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
She's a narrative designer at Obsidian Entertainment and makes video games. She worked on Pillars of Eternity, which is an awesome video game from Obsidian. And we talked to her about her process, about working as a narrative designer, where her ideas come from. It's not, you know, it's not supposed to ask a creator that.
But we do
talk about that. I just didn't ask her that directly because it's cheesy to ask that.
It's like one of those questions that everybody knows you shouldn't ask that exactly, but it's like you kind of want, everybody's process is different.
Well, as an interviewer and as a sometime creator myself, I'll tell you this. It is, I think, an important question. But the way you word it is important. But saying that is,
it's so, like,
that exact phrase is just a cliche.
It's a cliche.
And plus,
and
it
then,
doesn't, because you're, if you talk to somebody, they're going to tell you about their life.
Right.
They're going to tell you about, like Ed Brisson, like we talked to Ed Brisson.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I got a guy in there. And he talked about how, I asked him, like, why are you obsessed with crime stories? All your stuff is like true crime. And he told me that his dad was a cop.
Yep.
And that he was like a hooligan
growing
up. And so he has been kind of on both sides of that, and he wants to tell those kind of stories.
Right.
Now, I could have said where your ideas come from, and he could have said, well, you know, my dad was a cop in Ottawa or wherever he's from. He's Canadian. And and we could have gone from there, but instead we got into it, you know, by saying, I've noticed this thing about your work. Reveal something of your process to me. but without saying, where do ideas come from?
And that's so much more interesting to put it that way, because it also gives the person that you're talking to a starting off point, as opposed to saying such an open-ended question, yeah. Where do your ideas come from? My brain. Next question. I don't know.
I have a box that I push a button and something comes out, and I've been told that a random person on Earth dies when I push the button.
Oh my God, stop it.
That's Twilight Zone.
I knew it was something.
Isn't it? That's a Richard Matheson thing, isn't it? I know they remade it as a horrible, horrible film recently called The Gift or something like that. James Marsden was in.
Oh, would you leave James Marsden alone?
Guy's in bad movies. I love him, but he's in bad movies.
I love him so much. And he's taking so much butt in Westworld. I'm so happy.
Yes. And he is. Yeah. And he is. He's probably. Anybody watching Westworld? I don't want to ruin anything. If you're not, and if you don't, and you don't care, just hold your breath for like 2 minutes. You'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do, or if you're interested, get it. HBO Westworld. It's awesome. This last episode, we didn't see Dolores at all.
No.
And I like Dolores, but I think Teddy might be my favorite character. Yeah. And I remember saying early on when we're watching it that he is set up as the sort of romantic hero, sort of lead, you know, the opposite of Dolores. But I always thought that, you know, I think Teddy's got a dark side, though. He wears a gray hat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he is either good or bad, depending on who he's hosting, whoever the guest is that picks him up.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the characters on the show are like that. They all have a face, like a literal face,
right.
A robot face. But like they have, you know, they have like that role that they play in the story, but that role can shift.
Yes.
And I don't want to give away too much, but yeah, it's a really great show. Teddy's going dark.
Yes.
Because he's hooked up with like the worst player in the game.
Yeah. Mr. Ed Harris. So there you go.
But let's not say too much about that.
No.
How you doing?
But watch the show. I'm doing good.
Good.
Besides, you know, the state of the nation and
All right.
The presidency.
Let's make people happy.
And my cold black heart.
If that was really true, you wouldn't care. Like me.
Yes, I know. I almost think the real thing that draws me back is I care too much. No.
But where do your ideas come from?
Yeah, I know. I'm just kind of angry, but I'm going to do my best to get past it. So how are you doing, Cal?
Better than you. I'll be doing even better when we do some news. So, of course, the big story on our last show, or maybe two shows ago, was Doctor Strange.
Yep.
And its success. It has made a ton of money, and it has pushed Disney past the $6 billion box office mark.
Wow.
Yes. It is the second film studio to get $6 billion in a single year. Universal made 6.89 in 2015 on the back of a dinosaur, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's going to get even higher. They're probably going to blow past that Universal total with Rogue One, Star Wars
story. I was just going to say, excuse me. Yeah, totally going to blow past it with Rogue One.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is good because it means there's... nerd enthusiasm. There are nerd properties for people to go check out and share. And I think Universal, we don't really know. I mean, I didn't really like Jurassic Park or World. A lot of people watch Jurassic World, the Transformers and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's all fine and good. But Disney, generally, very high quality, very enjoyable.
There's something
of
substance.
If not totally original.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's really good news. Although this is, it's called a monopoly, right? I mean, that's what this is.
Well, I mean, you look at it and it's like they have Marvel Studios.
Disney.
They have Star Wars.
Star Wars.
And then they have their own, like, you know, Disney properties, which have always been, you know,
early buzz on
popular.
Moana is it is very good. It is matches up to possibly The Lion King in terms of quality.
Wow.
That's a bold statement.
That is a bold statement.
Yeah. I'm
absolutely
not sure that it's true or not, but I hope so.
Yeah.
Hey, guess what? More good news. See, I told you there's good news. Young Justice Season 3 has been approved. It is officially in production.
I heard that. That is great news.
After years and years of campaigning by producers Brandon Vietti and Greg Wiseman, they finally got it. It's going to happen.
Awesome.
We don't have anything. We don't have story. We don't have a voice cast. I mean, I'm sure the entire voice cast would be happy to come back.
I'm sure.
And we talked to Greg at Convergence,
mm-hmm.
As we also talked to Carrie Patel at Convergence of this year. And Gremlins. Gremlins 8, the interviews.
I know,
But we did have a good time talking to both of them, and Greg was, he's a smart guy, he's a nice guy, and he was very impassioned, mm-hmm. and he had a very practiced spiel about how we could get this show back on the air.
Well, I think he's been talking to a lot of people,
yes.
and I think something that has been on the forefront of a lot of people's minds is just like they really enjoyed the series, and it was only two seasons. Like, what can we do?
Yeah.
And fans have been asking, what can we do? And so then there was the campaign to watch it on Netflix.
Yes.
And
that was pretty much Greg's thing. It's just, you know, watch it on Netflix, tweet about it on social media. Keep it in the conversation.
Yes. And that seems to, at the very least, have helped, I would think, because a lot of people did stream it.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I did. I watched it, but I also just, I do that thing where you just put it on.
Well, I mean, anything
you go to bed.
That helps the numbers, seriously.
Do you think that when they look at the numbers, they go, all right, these numbers are after 2 a.m. I think we can just discount. Those don't count.
No, I don't think that they do. I mean, how can they?
Okay.
I mean, the same with any, like, with the Nielsen ratings. They don't know if somebody's eyes are actually on that TV.
Right.
You know, you could be doing chores around the house, or you could just have a TV on in the background. Maybe you like background noise. I don't know.
Yeah. whelmed. Definitely whelmed.
Yes.
And that's a joke, I guess. hey, more news.
All right.
Notice I didn't say good.
Oh.
An American Werewolf in London is set to be remade with Max Landis and writing it, and Kirkman, Robert Kirkman, producing it. Yes. That's not... You have to talk.
I hate this.
It's not great. I mean,
here,
he's literally...
A couple things.
From what I understand, like, John Landis, the original director of the original film, is involved in closing the deal.
His father.
Yeah, and... Yeah, not a coincidence there. Yeah. And so he's involved in closing the deal. And so, I mean, it's total.
Yeah.
Don't you want to?
Nepotism?
Okay. Yeah, it's nepotism. You say nepotism. I say a creative through line.
Okay.
First of all, why remake it? Dumb. Oh, here's why. Because an American Werewolf in Paris, like, sucked. why not do an American Werewolf in Chicago or something like that, you know? Yeah, not a big Max Landis fan. I don't know.
Hasn't
I don't
really
know what it is.
Shown
He's
anything.
The Trump of Hollywood. Okay, I said it. I was trying to hold back. And no,
wow.
No, I don't know. This is a show full of
that.
Bold statements.
Yeah. I just, why remake it? The point is it's charming in the certain way that, like, older horror movies or whatever have the certain, like, the effects aren't, like, super great, but for the time, they were freaking amazing. And you can still enjoy that.
They're,
you know,
great for now.
Well, they are pretty
That's
great
Rick
for
Baker,
now.
Dude.
But what I like about that movie as well is, like, I think the story is actually pretty good, and there's actually a lot of really great comedic moments in it as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Which
you're
gets
never,
overlooked.
Cast it right now in your head. I mean, you're never going to find anybody like Griffin Dunne or the main guy whose name I'm forgetting right now.
I can't even.
Jenny Agutter show up in a cameo or something like that, you know, to just pay homage to the original.
I mean, you'd like need, like, I almost feel like you need some up and coming people who nobody's really heard of.
Right, but
or
it'll
something
be,
like that.
Yeah, but it'll be Ryan Gosling. And what about Ryan Philippe?
He's got the hair.
Where is that guy?
I don't know.
Get
that's
that guy
a,
back.
That's a good question.
I miss that guy.
Yeah.
So that's not great. If you're Max Landis, don't you want to make your
do
own
your
thing?
Do your own thing.
Do you want to be? Do you want to show everybody how far the apple can fall from the tree?
Like, what are they going to improve exactly?
I don't know.
I mean, the effects will be different, obviously, but other than that, like, the script, I feel like, is pretty dang solid. And
it's all right.
Okay.
It's got problems.
It has problems. But, like, seriously, what are you going to do?
I don't know. Well, we'll find out. How about some good movie news?
Yes.
Neku Atsume, the popular mobile app game about cats, is getting a live-action film adaptation. It will not be helmed by Max Landis.
Yay! That's exciting.
Yes.
I wonder who they're going to get to voice Tubbs. Jeez. That is my first question.
What about Conductor Whiskers, though?
They've got so many great names, and they're so ridiculous. What about Mr. Meowgy? I am so serious.
Joe DiMaggio?
Yes, exactly.
Miao Zedong?
Yes.
I don't think that's a real one. We don't really know a ton of stuff about it. It's supposed to come out in 2017. I think it is going to be a Japanese production, but I'm sure they're going to attempt to make it sort of, you know, worldwide release. And it's going to feature a frustrated writer who's in need of a change of pace. And he heads out to the country and to rediscover his groove. And he gets inspiration from a bunch of friendly stray cats.
I love it. It sounds ridiculous.
When they
amazing.
Say live action, they're talking about like Smurfs, right?
Like the Whoa, cats this are gonna, is live action? I thought it was going to be like a cartoon.
Live action. The cats are going to be CG. Don't you think?
Yeah, I would think so. I don't know how you
Central
could...
casting. I need a fat white cat. The fatter
that
the better.
That eats a lot. Yeah, I don't think you're going to get... First of all, you're good luck filming this thing. It's going to take years because you're not going to get cats to do what you want them to do.
Right. Right. Yeah, cats are notoriously difficult actors. As anybody who was in Anne Frank in high school can tell you.
Oh, boy.
My school used a real cat.
Really?
Somebody had a cat that they was just real chill and was comfortable with 200 people looking at them in the dark. And so it worked out fine. But I'm sure a lot of other high schools, when they do Diary of Anne Frank, use, you know, like a stuffed cat or something like that. Or just change it to a stuffed animal or something
like that. Well, yeah, no kidding. I mean, that is a really chill cat, first of all. You're not going to find that.
Nerdy.
Everywhere.
Nerds.
Yeah.
Talking about Anne Frank. How about some quick little news hits as we head out of this segment?
Sounds good.
It's been confirmed that Michael Keaton will be playing the Vulture in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yes.
And here's my thing. They always want to do the thing where you hire an actor to get that dude's face or that lady's face.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if they're like the Lizard or something like that, you give them some ability that allows them to just be normal famous movie star face for a while, and then they can flip over and become weirdo or something.
Right.
And it's subverted with great things like Carl Urban playing Dredd and not taking his helmet off the entire time.
Right.
Or Tom Hardy.
Yes.
And just, you know, going the whole way. And so I hate that when they don't do that. And for this, I kind of hope they do.
Yeah?
Because I want to see Michael Keaton's face.
I know.
I don't want them to put him in the...
The full-on
green striped
right
suit
away.
With the fur collar, you know, and he's just like, rah, and give him like a fake nose, clearly, because he's a vulture, right?
Right.
Don't do that. You know, try to get him as much as you can, because he's such a, you know, magnetic performer.
Yeah.
I don't want you to bury him under layers of crap.
I'm glad he is doing more stuff now. I mean, he was kind of on like hiatus for a little while.
Yeah.
But I'm glad he's back and he's doing stuff, and I think it's really cool that he's playing the bad guy.
Yeah, it will be cool. Tom Holland, of course, playing Peter Parker, a.k.a. the Spectacular Spider-Man in that film. He is signed on for 6 films on his Marvel contract.
Wow.
So that is 3 Marvel Spider-Man movies, and then 3 like optional type things where he'll show up somewhere or whatever.
Is that already counting Civil War, do you think?
I think this is going forward.
Okay.
So he owes 6 from now.
Okay.
And that's an important thing, you know, in this day and age, especially in this shared universe kind of world that they've got, which I think is amazing, but has to be a nightmare. Clearly, they're not hurting for money, so they can make these kind of deals. But one of the things that I think was a problem for getting Cumberbatch signed on for Doctor Strange when it took so long is because they had to negotiate a multi-picture deal with the most famous, most sought-after actor in the world right now.
Right.
That's kind of why they lost Joaquin Phoenix, because he was like, oh, yeah, I'll be Doctor Strange. They're like, okay, we need you for like 8 movies. And he's like, oh, I'm not doing that. I got like fake rappers to play and other things to do. So that's how they kind of lost him. But
right.
So, yeah, it'll be cool. I guess I didn't go talking about that same thing, shared universes and Doctor Strange. I guess I didn't realize how integral he'll be now. It is not. He didn't just show up and then, oh, yeah, there's a guy that's Doctor Strange. They're going to have him be in a lot of these films. And of course, you want to. You've got Benedict Cumberbatch.
Well,
go for
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And I think you had mentioned that the post-credit scene in Doctor Strange was probably just a scene from Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, I don't think so. I think you're right now. I think you're right.
Really?
Because I know it was directed by Taika Waititi, the director of Thor Ragnarok.
Ah, okay.
And so it'll probably be like, so the Civil War scene was at the end of... whatever the pants.
Oh my gosh, was that Ant-Man or something?
Yeah.
I want to say it was Ant-Man.
I'm getting them all mixed up now.
I know. It's terrible.
There's no Howard the Duck, I'll tell you that much.
That one I know.
Speaking of superhero movies, Bryan Singer is out at Fox over the X-Men franchise. He's taken off.
Really?
Yes. And now Fox is looking at rebooting the X-Men. Didn't they just literally reboot it?
What the hell, Fox?
If you are Sophie, what's her name, and the kid who played, and Cody Smith McPhee or whatever, Mrs. McPhee and the other McPhees, you're going to be like, excuse me, what?
Yeah, I think, yes, absolutely. Because especially they didn't really get a whole lot to do in the last movie. Yeah. There were so many characters. It's like, sorry, kids, we all need to be in it.
And
so.
Fox has to be sort of bitter. It's got to be bittersweet for them because it's like, okay, we've got Jennifer Lawrence, still a draw, but we've got Jennifer Lawrence and we got to pay her more and more all the time. And she's doesn't want to wear the blue makeup anymore. So she's just, which again, people, it's weird. People love seeing Mystique for some reason. They love movie Mystique. They love her.
They love her all in blue.
And you think, oh, let's keep Jennifer Lawrence's face on here as much as possible. We got this famous actress, most famous face in the world. People want to see it. I think people would actually rather see
Mystique,
blue Mystique, than see Jennifer Lawrence's face. So, nothing wrong with the face. I just, it's a funny kind of thing.
It is weird.
So yeah, that they're looking to do that. They also have pretty much. I don't think they've signed the deal, but they are planning a Deadpool 3. That cool. was supposed to feature X-Force.
Okay.
So now you've got a New Mutants movie in the works by Simon Kinberg at Fox, and you've got an X-Force movie. X-Force is, of course, the team that was the New Mutants, was turned into X-Force by Cable. So if you time it right, you can, once you finish the second New Mutants movie or whatever, you could have that cast just walk into the X-Force movie.
Wow. Do you think that Fox is going to time it right, though?
Fox can't do anything.
I'm sorry. I went a little cross-eyed when you were talking about it.
So of course not.
And I mean, I like X-Men, but I'm not an expert in any ways. See what I did there? But I know you are. At least I feel like you are. At least the resident expert here
in these parts.
Yeah.
Not in other parts. No, I would not even come close. But yes.
So, I mean, how are other people going to keep this straight, you know, who don't read any of the comics?
I don't know. You look at DC, they are rebooting mid-movie at this point. Fox has started this whole mess, but they've had trouble defining it as it goes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Marvel's going to have to face this, too. They've been fortunate enough to have huge stars, great success, lots of money, good stories, great movies. And so, but at some point, they're going to have to... Chris Evans is going to not, he's going to want to go make another crappy movie or something.
Right.
Robert Downey Jr. is, you're just going to have to give him a planet. Like, that's going to be his salary.
Right.
And so you got to get rid of people.
Mm-hmm.
And how are they going to do it? Are they going to, you know, warp reality? I mean, they've kind of got an out coming up with an Infinity War. If Thanos changes reality, now Captain America looks like this, I guess. And it doesn't look like Chris Evans.
Right.
You could do that, or you could just start all over. Nobody knows.
No. Yeah, I know. Do we have any idea, like, why Singer left, or was he asked to leave, or...
I think he's just, you know, it's a good time.
Okay.
The last film was not considered a success. I mean, it was a success financially, but people are not excited about it. You already, plus, you've got the most famous sort of time travel-ish kind of retcon-y story in comics canon, Days of Future Past, and it worked fine for the film, but you kind of blew it. Like, that was your chance to reboot.
Yeah.
And you didn't really do anything with it.
No.
Except just do, people love this. They're set in time periods. So the next one's in the 80s.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you don't really do
but
anything
then
with
you
it.
Didn't, yeah.
Yeah. I think they played 99 Luft Balloons or something like that.
Right. There was 80s music and 80s clothing.
Right. Yeah.
But nothing really changed with how they presented the characters.
Remember how the world like blew up in the 80s because Magneto blew it up?
Oh, that's weird. I don't remember it like that. Maybe that's an alternate...
So you're right. I think keeping it straight is kind of a struggle and a big deal. One more story. J. Scott Campbell, we talked about on a previous show. He got in a little hot water because he drew a variant cover of the Invincible Iron Man, the incorrigible, the incontinent Iron Man. No, it's Invincible Iron Man. And
Riri.
I think it's like Riri, right?
Yeah, I think it's Riri.
Or is it Riri?
Riri?
I think it's Riri. Anyway, Riri.
It's R-I-R-I.
Riri Williams is the new character who is taking on the mantle of the Iron Man, or actually she's called Ironheart. She's a 15-year-old girl who's a genius and builder, and she sort of Tony can't be Iron Man anymore. She kind of steps in. And J. Scott Campbell, a noted, what did I call him? Booty Man, I think is what I called him.
I think so.
A noted cheesecake artist provided a variant cover that a lot of people think was just too sexual for a 15-year-old girl. And also, I just want to comment also that I didn't necessarily have a problem with the... I didn't think it was over-sexualized. I just didn't think it was very good. This guy's been around for a long time. He's a good artist, and he delivered kind of a lazy piece.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we reported on this as well, that he took upon himself to draw a new cover.
Yes.
That would not be published. It was just for his own personal rehabilitation, probably publicly.
Right.
Called Riri Rethink, and it's a much better cover. It's much better art.
It's
He's clearly spent
really
time
cool.
on it. It looks cool. Well, it turns out that Marvel is going to publish it as a variant cover for issue 2.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
So he got what he wanted.
Well, you know what? I'm okay with that because he didn't know that going in, you know, and his...
Oh, he didn't know going in that everybody would be offended by his over-sexualized 15-year-old.
No, that's not what I meant. What I meant was when he redid the drawing, he didn't know that he would get a variant out
kind
of it.
Kind of probably thought, though, right?
Well, maybe he thought there was a chance.
That's kind of his thing now, is that he basically just... He's like Adam Hughes, although Adam Hughes is doing the Betty and Veronica comic right now. But
sure.
He just gets paid to do variants. Covers. Yeah, commissions, sketches, you know, and so a J. Scott Williams cover is, or Campbell, goes for a lot, you know?
Right.
And so he knew if he just drew this, it wasn't just going to sit on his desk. Somebody would come knocking.
I guess.
Is it? Okay.
I feel like I don't like this story as much anymore.
I ruined it for you.
Yeah, you did.
Here's how I feel. Here's my view of morality. I don't care what you think. I don't care what's in your heart. If you're doing what you're supposed to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, if you do the right thing for the wrong reasons, you did the right thing. I don't care. I can't control. I'm not the thought police. I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know
right.
how you feel about stuff. So, slow golf clap for him, I guess.
Sure.
I mean, he did the right thing.
Yes.
It's a much better work. It shows that the fans, their voice matters, and that people are looking for stuff like this, and we don't live in the 90s anymore. With the thongs and the Lady Deaths and the whatever else is.
Right.
Jim Balent, Catwoman. I showed you that.
Yes, you did.
Your eyes are like saucers.
Yeah, I know.
Wait till you see Tarot. Don't go see Tarot.
No.
No.
Mm-mm.
When she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she puts on a radio.
Okay, let's get rolling with our interview with Carrie Patel, recorded this year. We'll just get right into it. Here it is. We're here with author and narrative designer Carrie Patel. You're a multi-hyphenate. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been on the show before, so our listeners might be familiar with you. But just to give them a refresher, you are the author of the Recoleta series. And you're also a writer and, like I said, a narrative designer for Obsidian Entertainment. And I have to ask, the most important question I can think of is, working for Obsidian, do you get free games?
Well, you know, we do have a pretty impressive library of games that we can borrow from for free. So
okay.
That's pretty awesome.
Okay. No, that works.
And we do get to take tax deductions on gaming systems or games that we buy on our own because it is research.
That is great. I love that. It's so cool.
It is fantastic.
Do you have, we could talk about you being a gamer in a little bit, but what systems do you have? What's your thing?
We have at home a PlayStation 4. My husband and I got it a few years ago because we'd both been PC gaming a bit more, but we wanted something that we could, you know, play on the couch together.
Sure.
So we got a PS4, and then we never thought we'd be a two-console household, but on Prime Day this year, there was a pretty fantastic deal on the Xbox One, and there were a lot of titles that we wanted to play that are... available through their backwards compatibility, and they're always bringing more on. So
okay.
We got one of those, and we've been very happy with it as well.
Your house is on fire. You have to take one of them out. There's time for one. Which one?
I guess I would really take my dog, actually.
She has okay, to all right. Well, yeah.
She's wagging her tail now. probably the Xbox, just because, yeah, I mean, there aren't a whole lot of exclusives that we end up playing. And yeah, for us, the backwards compatibility is pretty big.
Yeah, that's
Heron just did a playthrough of Fallout New Vegas. We just did a playthrough of Portal together. And that's, yeah, that's all been a lot of fun to do.
Let's talk about the Recoleta series. The Buried Life and Cities and Thrones are both out, and you have a third book, I believe, on the way.
Yes, I am just finishing up The Song of the Dead, which will be the third and final book in the series.
Cool. Any tentative release date for that?
Should be next summer.
Okay, cool. Next summer. Can you talk about the roots of the series?
Sure. So I started writing the first one in college. It was one of those.
Sure.
I'd done a study abroad trip to Argentina. And there's this really amazing district in the city of Buenos Aires called Recoleta.
Sure.
And there's a very famous cemetery there where lots of Argentinian luminaries are buried. And it's I guess kind of like the one in New Orleans if you've ever been there. It's all these above ground mausoleums.
Sure.
There it's I think everything's a little more tightly packed together, and it just looked like a little city.
Right. This is I haven't been there, but I've seen Easy Rider, I think, where they have a big scene set there.
So I don't know. Like I kind of got that image and that idea stuck in my head. I think I was a little bit fascinated by just sort of like Victoriana and the whole Gaslight flavor and Phantom of the Opera and just sort of the mystique and mystery of, that set of genres.
Yeah.
And I had a very long bus ride from Bariloche back to Buenos Aires one weekend. And had not a lot else to do except sit on the bus, listen to my music, and sleep. And if I think of that now, I would think like, oh wow, that's incredibly boring. Why didn't I plan ahead and bring a book? But it was actually the best thing I could have done. There's something really useful about just having time to sit and be still and just kind of let your brain go, that I
Sure.
find it's really hard to, carve out. But that's where it started.
Yeah, especially with smart devices these days. I
Yes.
remember back before those, when I was bored, I would just sit and, think of good pitches or good hooks for novels, and now it's pretty much just Facebook. Yeah.
I get stuck with the news apps, which I mean
Oh,
it's
yeah.
good. I'm like, okay, I'm getting news, but I mean I also find that I'm reading, the same commentary on a lot of the same stories, and I wonder sometimes like, am I really getting anything new out of this? I think I'm really just looking for something to do right now.
Yeah. It's that what is it, the rat hitting the button, like the stimulation? Yeah. I think I've heard you describe the series as kind of a post-apocalyptic sort of story or setting.
Yes.
Can you talk about why you wanted to do that as opposed to just a normal steampunk, back in time, like in the Victoriana, like you mentioned?
I think I was interested in sort of the idea of a civilization that breaks down almost entirely and then sort of rebuilds itself. And imagining, what it would look like and sort of, what trappings of their old civilization they would take and how those would sort of, under these little in these little petri dishes, of cities, how those would develop and blossom into new things. And what it would also be like for a society that was afraid of its own history.
Ah.
And where people, thought the past was a very bad thing, full of very foolish people, and that, even just the idea of learning the things they did and why they did them, and the forces that sort of drove them to this breakdown, that in of itself would be a dangerous thing, and that,
Sure.
then that information could be almost like a disease. So I that's those are sort of the ideas I wanted to explore.
That's heady. There, well, I mean, just to put it out there, there seems to be a real social element to your work in general. I mean, as in, you're not just writing, ray gun books here. The societies of your novels they're dealing with a lot of the same crises that are we are today. Can you talk about why you find that important to put into or integrate into your work?
I wonder sometimes if it's something that, that we writers do intentionally, like thinking, oh, I'm going to, write an insightful, commentary on this thing, or if it's something that just happens because it's what we're around and these are the problems that we're kind of, that we're all turning over in our heads. And, for us in fiction, it comes out in our stories and our worlds and the conflicts that people deal with.
Yeah. To that end, when we had spoken to you at Convergence of this year, you had talked about an idea for, or maybe a manuscript for your corporate Mars colony story that you're working on.
Yes.
Can you talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah, that's the next one in the pipeline for me.
Okay.
So this actually came up from a discussion that my husband and I were having on Valentine's Day, because this is just the sort of thing we talk about. It was sort of just a bunch of what ifs, and it was one of those things where sort of two different ideas came together, and in between them there was a story. And the first idea was that, we have currently the technology, a lot of the technology that we would need to begin Mars colonization, and to begin putting, people and structures on Mars. And the second idea was the concept of bare branches, which is the sort of gender imbalance for young males in certain parts of India and China, which will mean that probably for the next, 100 or so years, the generations that are growing up now and that will continue to grow up will contain millions of unmarriageable males.
Right. The marriage squeeze, I think I've heard it described as.
Yes, and there are all sorts of political and social instabilities that correlate with the marriage squeeze, because you have all these people who are not able to invest in the traditional way in families and in their society, and so, oftentimes, bad things happen as well, when you don't have people who can, invest and kind of plant roots and,
Right.
have the idea that they will have a legacy that goes on after them.
Yeah. It's a great idea. I'm jealous because you beat me to it. But do you think that the best sci-fi deals with these future trends and the way that we see things going?
It's hard to say, because I feel like oftentimes a lot of sci-fi is also very off. Like, you look at the future that,
Well, they get it wrong.
right. Like, I don't know. I feel like if you look at a lot of the futures that were envisioned by, sci-fi writers in the, 50s, 60s, and 70s, that's, still not really the world we live in.
Yeah.
And I think the thing with sci-fi when you're looking forward is that it's sort of impossible to break away from where you are right now.
Yes.
But I still think it's an interesting exercise. And I think certainly with the near future stuff, it is a way to say, like, with what we're on right now, where might this be headed?
Right, exactly. As far as the bare branches sort of phenomenon and the marriage squeeze and things like that, I mean, do you see those societal roles changing in the future, as far as like castes and universal marriage and et cetera, on our planet, I mean?
I think everything changes, I don't think that there are really many or even any probably cultures that stay exactly the same. I think there's certainly, a narrative that, like, oh, well, we do things the way our parents did them, the way their parents did them, and so on and so forth. But I think all societies sort of adapt to the times they're in, and to the difficulties that people face, and some change faster than others.
Right.
And some are, more overtly open to change, but I
Sure,
think
yeah.
everything changes.
Yeah. You're clearly a well-traveled person. How has travel to other places and experiencing other cultures affected your work and yourself as a writer?
I think for me, one thing that travel and that, reading good fiction have in common is the sense of wonder, and the sense that you are going to a new place and experiencing something new. And maybe looking at the world through a different set of eyes.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, yeah, I mean, and obviously, you're still always doing this from your own perspective. But I think that, yeah, travel and fiction both just open up other physical places, other, sort of emotional and societal places,
Yeah.
up to you. And I think it's very exciting. They're both very exciting.
Yeah, I think that it was like Mark Twain, I believe, that said that travel was fatal to people's prejudices and their narrow-mindedness.
I would certainly like to believe that's true.
Is there anywhere that you'd love to travel that you have never been to yet?
Oh, wow. There's so many places, actually. I'd love to go to Iceland. I'm really curious about Iceland, and I hear that they've got, I don't know, like something like one of the highest, numbers wise per capita readers in the country. Like, there's a huge literary culture, and it just seems like such a fascinating, beautiful island from everything I've ever seen of it.
We talked before when we talked at Convergence
about your working process? I think you mentioned that outlines are really important to you, but do you need a certain type of environment to really produce? Like, what's your setup?
I guess I'm a creature of flexible habits.
Okay.
I like to try to set aside sort of the same periods of time, more or less each day. And I have kind of my favorite places, that I'll go and write for each period of time. Although sometimes if I'm feeling kind of stuck or kind of restless, I'll go to my second choice, and that'll feel right.
So you have multiple places, like a circuit?
Yes.
Okay.
I work, let's see. So yeah, in the morning I usually get up early, get ready, have breakfast and all that. And then I have a desk, just kind of in our living area right by the window, and I'll set up there, probably have a cold cup of coffee and or a cup of cold coffee, that's much more appealing. And sit there and work for an hour or two.
Okay.
And then around lunchtime, at the office, I'll usually go sit outside on my break because the weather's always perfect in Southern California. Bring my computer, just find a shady spot and write for about an hour.
Sure.
And then after work, I work pretty close to where I live, so I'll usually, try to find either a coffee shop or a nice green space on the way home. Sit outside, work another hour or two, get as much done as I can, and then go home.
Sure. You wrote for Pillars of Eternity, the Obsidian Entertainment game, which has an amazing real-life story. It was kickstarted by Obsidian and received over $4 million, and I think it was the highest earning video game on Kickstarter at the time. As a narrative designer, that has to be a lot different from writing fiction. What considerations do you need to make in writing a quest line or a story element rather than a novel?
It is quite different. I mean, I think for me, one big difference I discovered is, writing a protagonist, writing a story with a protagonist versus writing content for a player. I realized that there are a lot of assumptions, you can make about your protagonist when you're writing a novel or a short story or, pretty much anything else,
Sure.
that you can't necessarily make about your player, especially when you're trying to write, very sort of player-oriented, role-playing scenario where the player really is defining their character and the way their
Sure.
character interacts with the
And not
world.
just watching some story play out in front of them that they don't interact with.
Yes. So there's the element of interactivity, like making sure that the player character is the one at the center of the story, is the one, usually driving the action forward, and is the one making meaningful choices. And also just the information side of things. Like a lot of time, you can have your novel characters figure out the things you need them to figure out, in the way that works for you because of plot or dramatic tension or what have you.
Right.
But players, you have to be a bit more explicit about providing that information, just because you don't always know where everyone's coming from. You don't always know, how long it's been since they picked up the game or how focused they are on playing
Right.
at that minute.
Right.
And so obviously you don't want to act like you're spoon feeding someone, but you do have to be more specific and more direct with the information you give them.
I've always wondered about that. I'm writing for role-playing games, and you must have like dialogue trees and like story trees depending on the decision the character makes and whether they succeed at a certain thing or not. It has to be, I don't know who manages that, but it must be really tough to manage.
There is a lot. We're always working on our documentation process. There's this, sort of fine balance between, on the one hand, having everything complete and thorough enough that the information is always, it's there and you can refer back to it.
Right.
But on the other hand, having it be, lean and focused enough that you actually will refer back to it and you will find the information you need.
Yeah.
And one thing that's kind of unique about Pillars is that, it's an isometric, top-down game. We don't do facial, we don't do all these
Right,
animations.
right.
Sophisticated kind of up close cutscene style animations. But when you do have that element in there, there's both, the additional, that's another tool that you have, but also, one that you have to use well. Like, is this character emoting what they need to emote? Is the camera following them the way it needs to follow them?
Are there ways that you have to make that more explicit in the dialogue, or what's the character descriptions?
So one thing we do write, we do include thing, descriptions, actions, sort of gestures, and basically all the stuff you would find in a novel.
Sure.
A little less of the description, but we do have that there, which is obviously a lot of fun to get to include as a novelist. But it also, I think, lets us be very specific and sort of very character focused with a lot of our writing.
Yeah, I have to mention that I do like that you guys have the, like you said, there's no facial animation, but you've got the little portraits, like the art, like from old Infinity Engine games, which I just, when I booted up Pillars of Eternity and saw that for the first time, it just brought me back to those days of the Icewind Dales and the Neverwinter Nights and everything. You're a gamer, clearly. What's your background as a gamer? Like, what were some of the first games you played? What got you hooked?
So the ones I grew up playing that I guess I can remember the most were the Sierra Adventure games and different Quest series. So, you know, King's Quest, Quest for Glory, the Colonel's Bequest, all of those. Like, I loved the story elements. I loved the narrative puzzle, you know.
With puzzles, yeah. Speaking of imparting information to the player, I just remember tearing my hair out on some of those games because there was something specific. You have to combine the thing with the thing and at the right time, and there's no internet back then, so...
Right, you either bought the hint book or you guessed and guessed and guessed.
Oh yeah, we had a whole my friends and I had a whole underground like information network of like, I think I figured out that puzzle.
Well, and that is the thing, like looking back on those, you know, I realized there were so many times, you know, where you could make the game unwinnable essentially by, you know, not doing something in Act 2 and then getting to a point in Act 3 or Act 4 where you couldn't go back. And and there's nothing to tell you, by the way, it's game over because you fed the pie to the bird. You didn't have the pie to throw at the Yeti.
Right.
You just don't know. And you're like, have I not figured it out yet? Or did I make a mistake? And where did I make that mistake? And yeah, looking back, a lot of those were very, very challenging. You know, at the time, I didn't know any better. It's like, well, this is what the game is.
Right. Game development has primarily been a male-dominated field in the past, and continuing into today, from Nolan Bushnell all the way up to, you know, Will Wright and Peter Molyneux. What have your experiences been like as a woman in the video games industry?
They've been very positive. I've been in the industry for almost 3 years now, you know, working at Obsidian, in the same position I'm in now, and I've had a very good experience. You know, I feel like I've gotten to make meaningful contributions to the content I've worked on. I feel like my that those contributions and those perspectives have been, you know, received well, have been respected. I feel like I'm part of a very positive, collaborative team. So, you know, I know there's a whole range of experiences that people have, but I've been very fortunate, and it might have been very positive.
That sounds really great. I'd have to imagine that after writing entire sections of a game, the experience of playing a game has changed for you. Are there things you notice now when you play as an industry insider?
I think sometimes I notice a bit more when I feel like I'm being pushed into a decision.
Sure.
You know, kind of pushed along in the story.
Right.
I realize that there, you know, there's a whole range of types of games, and, you know, some are very linear and your character is defined for you. And then some give you a bit more freedom. And the expectations for those are different.
Right.
Yeah. But I do notice now when sort of things happen because of plot or, you know,
right.
Oh, wait, my character just had to do this silly thing that I wouldn't have, you know, the cutscene incompetence, like I wouldn't have done this. So they did it to me in a cutscene so that my character would do it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that a term you use around the office? Cutscene incompetence?
I think it's a TV tropes term, maybe. I'm trying to remember where it originally, like which game it originally came up in reference to, but yeah, it's the idea that, you know, you play this character who can, you know, jump 20 feet, you know, shoot, get headshots all the time, you know, do pretty much anything. But then you get this character into a cutscene and, you know, someone slaps his gun out of his hand and says, I have you now.
Right. Yeah, right. I hate that. Is there anything that you're playing now? Anything you're focused on your Xbox or your PS4?
I've been, let's say I'm slowly working through The Witcher 3. I'm having a lot of fun with that one, but I know it's a very big game, and so I'm trying to pace myself. My husband and I just finished up a playthrough together of Portal. We play a lot of things together, just passing the controller back and forth.
Oh, sure.
I think next we're probably either going to start on Portal 2 or Red Dead Redemption.
Speaking of role-playing games and Pillars of Eternity, have you played any tabletop role-playing games at all?
I've played a little bit of Pathfinder, a little bit of D&D. It was either 3.5 or 4,
Okay.
forget which, but yeah, just not quite as much as I've played of not quite as much as I've played video games.
I have to imagine that the crew around Obsidian is probably into that sort of thing.
Yes, there are several lunchtime games going, several after work games going. I was part of the Pathfinder game for a while, but then I realized I needed to take some of that time to do more writing.
Oh, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
You have created these amazing worlds, especially with the Recoleta series. And while you're gathering all your sort of elements to put in, is there anything that you just couldn't make work or didn't fit or you just had to throw out because it was world breaking or just wasn't going to work for the story you were trying to tell?
Well, I guess I'll tell you after I finish book
Yeah, I was
three.
going to say maybe that's good.
But the fun thing about writing that one is that that series is that it's sort of the world has expanded with the story. The first book was about the city of Recoleta, and then a few things just outside the city. The second book, kind of zoomed out a little bit and looked at sort of the conflict in this region and between a couple of cities, and
Sure.
how do the things that happened in this one city then affect the neighbors, and how's that going to go down?
Right.
And in the third book, it's zooming out even more, looking both at a wider geographic area, and also about kind of the origins of how the world got to be the way it is. And so that's been, I think, a fun way to write, and I hope also a fun way to read, to sort of, start with something fairly small and manageable and then say, okay, let's look bigger. Okay, now bigger,
Sure.
and slowly build the world out from there.
When you write, do you? I know some writers, friends of mine, have a real trouble. They fall in love with characters or certain elements, and they have trouble sort of dropping them when they need to, or possibly killing them, or sort of de-emphasizing them. Do you find that that's a problem that you face when you write?
Not so much. I mean, at least I don't think so. I
You're
mean,
cold
I
with
get
it.
to, yeah, I mean, I get to things that I like, but at the end of the day, I really want to stick with what's gonna make the story interesting,
Sure.
and what's gonna make the character arcs interesting. I've heard from a few readers about a certain lovable character who dies in one of the books and how that made people feel. And it's funny because every time I hear that, there's a little part of me that goes, yes.
Good.
Because I know that that character also needed to die.
Okay, sure.
It would have kept things too simple for other characters if that character had stayed around.
I see. Okay.
And so I'm very happy with that decision. And in book three, I've looked at a few places and been like, does this person need to live, or are we done with this person?
You
Like,
gotta
what's
go.
it going to do to the stories? It is are the other characters getting too comfortable having them around?
I see. Okay.
You are a frequent attender of conventions these days. What was your logic on starting to go to conventions?
Honestly, trying to plug into the community a bit more. So my first convention was ApolloCon in 2013, I believe, which is a local Houston convention. And right after that, I went to WorldCon in San Antonio, which is
Oh, yeah.
also where I met my publisher and pitched my book.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up going to them, but I was kind of, as I was spending more and more time and energy writing, becoming aware that there was, actually a very big and personable sci-fi and fantasy writing community attending these conventions. And I realized, like, well, I should really go and try to be a part of this.
How has going to conventions affected you as a writer?
I think it's very exciting because, writing is something that you do by yourself.
Right.
And I think it's very easy to feel isolated, when you're spending kind of hours a day at your keyboard, just writing, and depending on whether or not you have a critique group and how often you meet and how you share, you may not really be sharing your work with other people or even sharing experiences with other people who are also working. And so for me, going to conventions has been a wonderful way to both connect with people who are enjoying my work, and to say, oh yes, this does have a home, this does go somewhere, this is worth it.
Right.
And also to connect with other writers and fans about the things we experience, both working and consuming media, and what we're excited about.
Any conventions coming up for you in the future?
Not at the moment. I'm just starting to think about where all I'm going to go next year.
Okay. And working on the your books.
Yes, that too.
Well, The Buried Life and Cities and Thrones are out now. Song of the Dead is out summer of 2017, and Pillars of Eternity is available on PC right now. Kerry Patel, thanks for joining us today. Come back anytime.
Thank you so much for having me.
I always enjoy talking to her, and I feel like we could talk forever.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah.
In fact, we did. We got like 45 minutes out of her at Convergence, and of course.
And then we lost it to the Gremlins.
Yes.
So
it's still, I keep talking about it. I mean, it still exists. I might be able to clean it up in some way, or I could almost definitely transcribe it. So maybe I'll do that. But it's a lot of the things that we covered in our talk with her. I was interested. I really want to see this book that she talks about with the bare branches idea.
Yes.
That sounds right up my alley. That sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I also like you know, the fact that she has that social element to her work.
Yeah.
It isn't just imagining vistas, you know, from the mind of
right.
M. Night Shyamalan.
It's a social commentary kind of woven into the story.
Yeah. Which, first of all, just right off the bat, makes your work, quote unquote, important.
Right.
You know, which is nice.
Right.
And somebody can't just discount your oh, it's, yeah, right,
yeah, whatever. It's sci-fi.
Your cute little fairy punk book or whatever
right.
it is. It's making you think things.
Yes.
But also, I want to read that anyway. I would be bored if it was just a book that was just about ray guns or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it makes it stories.
Not Ronald Reagan. I mean, like.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. It makes the stories are more interesting if there are actual stakes that you can relate to and like characters that you care about.
Yes. Yes. I didn't ask her though how she has time to game and create at the same time.
That would well, you know, put that
because
in the
as
bank
a gamer
for next
myself,
time.
Every second that I spend gaming instead of writing, I feel like I'm just punching a baby in the face.
Oh wow.
And the baby is
that's horrible.
Is my potential. It's little baby potential.
Oh no.
Little baby output. And I'm like, I'm not feeding you tonight, little baby.
No.
You can cry all you want.
Oh, this is a horrible image.
My stories are on. I don't know what I've
what
painted.
Are your stories? Yeah. Mass Effect? What's going on?
No,
here?
Like, you know, my
I know soap operas, but you're talking about games, so
right. So anyway, I want to mention again that The Buried Life and Cities and Thrones are her two books that are out currently. Her new book, The Song of the Dead, is coming out. I guess it's supposed to be summer, although I've heard May. I guess May's like early summer.
Yeah.
Anyway, like summer of 2017. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that you can go to Amazon and pre-order it and also get her other books there as well. Do it. Great person, great author, Kerry Patel. Are you ready to talk about Black Science Guy?
Yeah. What? I'm sorry. I think I'm on the wrong show.
Black Science Man?
No.
You pointed this out when you Google Black Science.
Yes.
You Google things, you always get suggestions.
Yes.
Sometimes skin crawling suggestions, but it just says like Black Science Man. It's like,
yep.
What? Is that a character I'm unfamiliar with?
Yeah.
Black Science Guy.
Yeah. I'm a little I'm a little upset that like that's something that comes up, and I'm a little disappointed in humanity.
Well, I'm a little weirded out. Yeah. we are talking about Black Science. Here's the tagline: Anarchist scientist Grant McKay has done the impossible! Exclamation point! Using the pillar, he has punched a hole through the barriers between dimensions, allowing travel to all possible universes. But now Grant and his team are trapped in the folds of infinity, the pillar sending them careening through a million universes of unimaginable adventure, sanity-flaying danger, and no way home.
Yes.
That is the tagline to the first volume, the first six issues of Black Science, collected in a trade paperback called How to Fall Forever. And it features exactly what we said. Grant McKay, a member or former member of the Anarchistic Order of Scientists, which is
just like, okay.
Okay. So no breaks on this one, huh, Rick?
Like, yeah.
You're just gonna blow it out.
Boom, boom, boom.
And he does. It is drawn and penciled by Mateo Scalera,
mm-hmm.
who is fantastic.
Yes.
And might have some bodies under his porch.
Stop.
He's an intense dude.
Sure.
I talked to him at Emerald City Comic-Con, and yeah, he's just like, he's got this like piercing
He's very sort of intense.
Stare. He looks like the characters he draws.
Yes.
Like he looks like he drew himself in like some kind of M.C. Escher-esque type thing.
Yeah. No, definitely. But you can tell he's, I mean, not with every artist you can't do this, but like you can look at him and you're like, I bet this person's an artist, you know?
Oh, yeah. And it's colored, quote unquote, colored by Dean White. But right. When we say colored, this is painted. The entire book is painted.
Which is pretty cool.
It is amazing.
And the colors are amazing.
We're just going to gush about this book, I guess.
They're saturated.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean that in the most positive way. They're very bold and striking.
Which is fitting.
Yeah.
Fitting this universe.
Mm-hmm.
As the book opens, we join our characters in medias res, as they say, already in trouble. And like we said in the summary, Grant McKay is a scientist who's built this thing called the Pillar.
Yep.
And it's just because it looks like a pillar, I guess. And the idea is, I don't really know if there's some kind of
pillar, like holding everything together.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some kind of
support,
wanky thing like that. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, it allows him to travel to other times. So it's kind of like Sliders meets Land of the Lost, kind of,
mm-hmm.
Because it's about these characters who, at least at the beginning of the story, have no control over where they're going, and
yes.
So they are. Have to stay near this pillar, and then it randomly sort of counts down. And so you could go to a lava planet and be there for like 10 minutes, or you can go to like an underwater planet and you're there for like 2 days.
Right.
And so that surviving in these multiple dimensions becomes, you know, the drama. That's what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
And all of these dimensions are described by McKay as the onion, basically. Mm-hmm. That's his theory, kind of the quantum leap. Roll the ball up, you know, and all your days touch each other or whatever.
Right.
The Eververse is like every possible universe. And so every time a big decision is made, you know, it sort of branches off and creates alternate universes. So that the pillar allows them to puncture the wall between our universe and these other alternate universes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that begins as a way to look at fish people.
Yes.
And it gets more complicated at the end of the book, which we'll talk about right now because we're going to spoil things. So
yep.
I guess the TLDR is go buy this amazing book.
Please do.
Which is still going on right now.
Yes.
Now we'll get into details. Yeah, so it gets complicated like at the end of this volume when an alternate Grant shows up to steal his kids away from our Grant.
Yep.
Because he believes that Grant is going to get those kids killed.
Because every Grant has gotten them killed.
Yes. It is the perfect fatalistic, nihilistic Rick Remender stuff that you've come to love and expect.
Mm-hmm.
This book reminds me quite a lot of all of his work, but a Fear Agent specifically, because Fear Agent features a hero who is traipsing across alien worlds.
Sure.
There's a lot of inner monologue in the Remender style, and it's a guy who has sins in his past that he's constantly trying to pay for, but he's also a person who just... He's a screw up, you know. He just can't seem to get it right. He just can't seem to pick.
That
he's a smart
like
guy.
McKay.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's classic Remender. Remender is he's famous, at least to me, for doing these kind of protagonists. You know, usually a dude who, like I said, has some kind of sins in his past
or present.
He's tortured by them.
Yeah,
he's self sacrificing. You know, he's trying to. You know, he's abusing his body, trying to solve whatever problem it is. And then there's like a ton of voiceover. And it's funny because
yes.
Remender kind of goes through the onion, like kind of splits up his own thing. Because now there's other characters that have voiceovers as well.
Yes.
It isn't just like the singular, you know, hero of the book, Grant McKay. Suddenly we'll switch to another guy and the guy's like, my dad always said that. It's like, whoa, 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 wait a minute, what? Wait, who's monologue is this?
I know.
It was a little confusing.
A little bit, but I did notice that they did try to help the reader out with, like, the colorist. They made the word boxes. They tried to make them different for the different characters.
Sure.
And you, for the most part, it seemed like, you know, oh, wait, now it's this person's narrative, you know, and now we're switching to this person. It reminded me a little bit, the way they did that, a little bit of The Wicked and the Divine. But however, The Wicked and the Divine, like, they make it, like, so abundantly clear that it's, like, this person talking, just because they really do the lettering and like, not just the colors.
I kind of think that, and we've already told people that, we've already sent people to get the book, so I'll just say this. I think that this was in 2013, I think it started. It's still going on now.
Yeah.
Remender has definitely done more different stuff since then, but I think he still needs to evolve more as a writer.
Okay.
Because he, the fact that you can make the generalized statement like, oh boy, so it's a male protagonist who's got a voiceover and he's running from aliens. Is there time travel involved? Sometimes. Okay. Right. Rick Remender, right?
Right.
It's an easy Jeopardy question. And so I think he needs to move out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And if he was going to do like one last fling, like one last hurrah in his own sort of personal milieu and style before he did something else, it would be this. He'd be getting it all out.
Right.
One bash and then I'm done.
Right.
I'm going to quit drinking. because, yeah, there's like a ton of alien worlds and stuff. And there's like four or five different voiceovers. And everybody is just a jackass. And they're all horrible people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's intense.
It's very intense.
It's black. I read this book sometimes and I'll have like multiple issues and I'll just go, I'm good. I'm going to give it like a week before I go back because this book can like drag you down.
Yeah.
In a good way. I mean, it's intense. It's tight. But yeah, sometimes I'm like, push back from the table and button my pants. I'm good on the black science for now. Yeah.
That's good to know because I would like to continue reading this series. But I have to tell you, just reading the first volume, I immediately, at the end of the sixth volume, issue number six, I immediately wanted to read the next one.
Yeah. And it's intense because, spoilers, they kill the main character at the end of the sixth issue. You know?
Yeah.
So now what?
Exactly. Well, I can't remember who did the foreword in the collected volume. I believe another
I didn't read it.
Writer. I read it.
You read everything.
I know.
You read the barcode.
I know. But one thing he mentioned was that Rick Remender is not afraid to kill off characters. And it's very true.
Oh, yeah.
You learn very early on.
He always seems to get paired. So we've talked about his storytelling techniques, which I think, I know he's got other knives in the drawer. I just think that he uses this one very often.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it's because of the artists that he gets paired with. He often gets paired with extremely talented artists. You look at Mateo Scalera.
Great gift when you're
writer. Look at his work on X-Force when he's with Jerome Pena. Wes Craig on Deadly Class, Greg Tacchini on Low. Like, he's often paired with these amazing artists who had this beautiful sort of tableau of images that maybe aren't quite comic book material.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They might kind of get in the way of the flow of storytelling.
You think so?
I don't know. I really don't know. You look at a guy like Michael Gatos, for instance. He's a great pairing with Bendis on Alias. And although I've seen Gatos do some very intricate, like detailed sort of work, a lot of times his work tends to be fairly basic.
It's loose.
Yeah, it's loose. And it sort of keeps the story going, keeps things flowing. I don't know how. I know that Black Science, like a lot of Image Comics, runs for a couple months and then kind of takes some time off.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they finish these things because the tiniest little detail. I read this digitally, and the screen that I read it on wasn't that big.
Sure.
So I did that thing that I hate, but I'm starting to kind of like a little more, where it's like the dynamic view, where it shows you like individual panels, which is not how you're supposed to read a comic book.
No.
Because they're not movies, they're comic books. But I did that for this because I didn't want to have to zoom in all the time.
Yeah.
And I would see a panel that would be big on my screen, but I knew that it was only like an inch wide or whatever, and the amount of detail in it is mind-blowing. Like, I don't know how he breaks it down. Like, if he's drawing individual things and then, like, computer sticking them, I don't know how he gets
all the
fineness of the detail. Yeah.
Huh.
And it just sets the tone for because every world they go to is nuts. Like, the first one is, like, there are temples riding on giant turtles' backs.
Uh-huh.
Lightning and thunder, and then they go to this world that's like a fun kind of desert world with it's got like a Star Wars cantina hotel that they end up staying at.
Yes.
And then they go to like a world with like monkeys and like these giant like volcanoes or like temples and stuff like that. And
mm-hmm.
it's crazy. And the amount of detail that he puts into everything. Like, there's this one thing where Grant is going to walk up some stairs or something, and you could easily just have, you know, banisters or whatever on the side. But like, it's a bunch of sticks that kind of go up the sides of the stairs, and they're all wrapped together with wire, and the sticks are all pointing like different directions, and like the wires are all in different spots, and it just the time to sit down and really go, I'm going to draw this, I'm going to draw this. It must take so much time.
Yeah. No kidding. But I was
watch him draw at Emerald City, and he was doing something amazingly detailed. And
of course he was.
He did it pretty fast. Uh-huh. it took a day.
When I was reading this, one thing I was thinking was just how diverse all these worlds were, and like how much of a gift like that is for the artists in a way, you know, and for Remender to just be like, yeah, do whatever, you know, you design it. Yeah, okay, there's fish people.
Yeah.
Do it. You know,
and to
it's
also
pretty cool.
Yeah, and also to I should mention Tokyo Ghost, Sean Murphy too. Sean Murphy is a very similar style to Scalera. I think they both have that. Do people call it scratchy? People who don't know what else to call it call it scratchy. But it's like
okay.
There's a lot of lines on the page, you know, and a lot of and he's not afraid to use motion lines. Like a lot of times he will.
He has great line work.
Yeah, yeah,
as they say in the biz.
If they do. You don't seem very confident about that.
I try.
Let's talk also about the colors. You were trying to talk about it before by saying it was saturated or rich or something.
It is. I mean, it's very bright and luscious. The colors really pop.
Yeah.
Their suits, in contrast, are kind of white and stark and scientist-y,
yeah.
You know.
But they still have little sort of details and fringes, literally.
Yes. The emblem?
They have
Do you want to talk about that?
The emblem's cool. But they have gloves, too, and the gloves have, like, these little tassels or something for some reason. Ostensibly, there would be, like, the buckle. Maybe this is how you put the glove on.
Right, to tighten them
but
or
But they
kind
of, they look sort of like Batman glove things that kind of come off.
Yes.
And so those are always flipping around because Grant's always throwing himself headlong into a monster's mouth or something like that. So that's, it's cool.
One thing I need to say, why did he think it was okay to bring his kids along?
Well,
I just can't wrap my head around
It is. It was an accident.
I know.
Yeah, they were in his lab. They were... just happened to all have suits on, like they were going to take a trip or something and test this
pillar. Except for Kadir.
And somebody sabotaged the pillar and it went off accidentally. And so it brought Grant, Kadir, his financier for his experiments, his kids, Rebecca, his assistant, who he's also having sex with.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Sean? What's the name of the...
Sean, yes.
The kid genius that works with him as well.
Sean.
And then Ward, who is like a... the security guy, basically.
The bodyguard.
And then the blonde chick, and I can't remember her name.
And Jen, who is another scientist who...
Oh, and Jen, who I forgot because she dies in like the second
page. I
wasn't
going to say it, but
she dies in the second page. Yeah.
Like I said, don't get too attached to these characters.
Right.
They're going to
die. We don't learn a lot about Jen. and so, they go through all this fun stuff. That doesn't say anything. Let me be more specific. So the story starts off. They're trapped by these fishmen who are trying to kill them. And they're riding like these crazy creatures. And they don't speak English, of course. And they kill Jen. And so Grant realizes that he's got to get back to his kids to protect them. But also the pillar is going to...
Is going to leave.
They can't control when it comes and goes, and it'll never come back.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least the chances of it coming back are infinitesimal. And so he has to, he has to push himself to the limit. He has to make a lot of sort of sketchy decisions. It's kind of like, a Rick Remender book.
Right.
He eventually gets there by, he also runs across, I guess the fishmen are in a war with the frogmen.
Yeah.
So he runs across some frogmen. And just so we don't think that he is completely unsalvageable as a character, he sees the frogmen like torturing this fish person slave that they have.
Yes.
And he thinks about the parallel between... We're introduced to all these horrible things about him, that he's cheating on his wife and that he's made a lot of bad decisions. And we're supposed to immediately forgive him because he saves this fish girl that these frogs are torturing.
Right.
It pays off, though, because later on, the fish guys show up, kill the frog guys, and they're like, cop a walk, it's all right. You know, and they let him go because he helped out. And you get, of course, you get that cool sequence where the frogs have like electric tongues or something for some reason.
Oh, so, that was really cool.
So Grant rips one of their heads off and then uses it as like a gauntlet with like a electro whip in it.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, that was a happy accident.
Yeah.
He did not know that that was going to go that way.
No. And a lot of things like that. There's everybody who does something in this. It's just always desperate. Everybody is completely desperate. The good guys, the bad guys, they all act rashly, and they're all doing things that they shouldn't. There's that part later on where alternate Grant comes and kidnaps the kids, and he's like, mm-hmm. "We gotta get out of here." And this, they're on the Cantina planet, basically. Yes. And he stops this car, and the alien's like, blah, 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 "What are you doing?" And he's like, he just blows the guy away. And they're like, "You killed that guy." He's like, "Doesn't matter. None of this matters. Let's go."
Right.
And you could easily just have yanked that guy, that alien, out of his car and just taken his car.
Yeah.
But everybody is just at 110% all the time.
That's very true.
Yeah. Which is why I have to put the book down sometimes.
I get that. It is very intense, and it's upsetting that his kids are there, and they're very young.
They're actually not that young.
Well, his oldest is 18.
And this would come down to, I mean, if we have to, we've just been gushing, so let's get, you know, let's be serious. Let's get real. Like the real world. I sometimes have trouble telling the characters apart.
Sometimes.
Grant's easy. He has a very
distinct nose.
Like Roman nose. And so that's clear.
There's more the ladies.
Amazing. Yeah, a lot of the ladies are kind of interchangeable. Pia is usually drawn. She's 18, but she's drawn with a larger head, you know, like a child.
Mm-hmm.
So she's usually, you could pick her out. But the other girl, Rebecca, also has dark hair as well.
Yep.
And so they are kind of interchangeable.
And so does his wife.
Yeah.
And his wife also looks like them. So it's like,
Well, I got the impression that his wife was like Asian.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess. That didn't totally come across to me in the drawings. But
perhaps not. And I think that Scalera, he works so hard on a lot of this stuff. I'm not saying that he skimps necessarily, mm-mm. but I think a lot of times you think that the characters, that's what we focus on. That's the most important thing to draw. I think the characters are kind of an afterthought for him sometimes. I think he's drawing all this other stuff, and then he goes, well, it's clear that Sean or whatever and Ward are looking at this one thing. And so unless it's like a close-up or whatever, he kind of draws them in. And he does have a style that can go from hyper-realistic to like hyper-stylized.
Sure.
You know, in the course of a couple panels.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of, sometimes the characters look weird. Like the characters look like kids. Like their heads look really big.
Okay.
And it might be because of their suits, which have the helmets and everything like that.
But sure.
It's not a complaint necessarily. I just remember the first time I read it, I was like, okay, I'm trying to pick out, like, who the kid is, but it could be this lady. The lady looks kind of like her,
right.
Does she have a pierced nose? I think she has a pierced nose, so maybe that's how I'm going to know that it's her.
Right, and...
But if you just give it her, like, purple hair or something like that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
What does Jen look like? I don't know. She's dead.
Stop. Jen has wavy hair, so...
She's got a wavy face now.
Oh, somebody stop hit her with a rock. But, yeah, that's another thing. Becca has these white spherical earrings.
Yeah.
That I noticed.
Very
they were
practical.
Fairly well
for a dimensionaut.
They were very prominent, and kind of reminded me of like an onion or a world or something.
Sure,
you know. And so, yeah, that's something else to look for. But yeah, I mean, if like you said, if they just made the hair color more distinct or something, it would have been easier. That's why they, you know, in anime, that's why they have blue hair. So you can tell the difference, because if they drew them all like realistically, like,
but that's lazy.
You think so?
Yeah.
But that's just the style.
Right. But like Kill la Kill, you're not going to confuse a lot of those characters because they are just completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't like, yeah, like High School of the Dead.
Well, look, it's
when
a
you can
trend
only tell the characters apart
from,
by their
ago.
Breast sizes or whatever.
Oh my gosh.
You're not working very hard to distinguish people. But do you think that creators just come to the project thinking, okay, we've got one head for everybody, and then sometimes they'll have blue hair?
No, I mean, look, they have a style. Here's the thing, though. So in Japan, most people are Japanese. Surprise.
Like, Fred doesn't look like Shaggy, even if you switch their hair.
This is true.
And Daphne doesn't look like...
Velma. The other one. Oh, boy.
Okay. I just killed our women writers sequence.
No, you didn't.
Because I forgot who the not hot one's name was. You're right. No, not Tina Belcher. Although similar, could be sisters.
Wow.
Finish your statement.
Same glasses.
This hole's getting very deep.
Yeah, I don't know. I lost my train of thought.
Okay, great.
Woo! Black Science, it's awesome.
Black Science Man. I don't know if we are. That's the title of the show for sure. I don't know if we are done. Do you have anything else to say?
I really enjoyed it. There was one other thing I wanted to say.
Oh, we didn't even talk about a lot of the cool stuff. Oh. Let me sell this to you.
Yeah.
Remember what you're going to say. I'm going to sell this.
Okay.
So we got temples on turtles' backs. We got froghead electro whips. Check. We've got future Indians.
Fighting, future Aztec Indians.
Yeah, fighting World War I Prussian or German troops.
Yes.
We've got. We got alien car chase.
You know, yes. I mean?
We've got possessed baby monkeys.
Yes.
Which probably would make Jamie Hewlett crap his pants and David Elburn.
And the baby monkeys are possessed by something that's in this plant.
Yep.
And
they're often
can go into other things besides monkeys.
It has this great, it's science fiction, but it has this great fairy tale logic because none of it makes any sense. Why is there a spirit gas inside plants that possesses monkeys? Nothing that I just said made sense.
No.
But it immediately establishes for us the quote unquote rules. So we know, we know what it is now. It comes out of this thing, it possesses people. And then later on when it possesses a character, and then that character comes back with the team, you know, okay, that's going to be a thing later.
Right.
Yeah. It's a good setup.
It is a good setup. It's a really good setup. So there's one point, Kadir, who is kind of set up as the bad guy. He's the financial. I mean, we're just
Nobody's
not supposed to trust him.
Good and bad in this.
I know, but we're not supposed to trust him because the main guy doesn't trust him.
Right, but...
And he's told... Kadir is the one who smashes the pillar.
That's a point that I want to make, but I'll finish your point.
I just was going to say there's one point when he's doing his internal monologue, and Scalia draws him, which I thought, and I don't know, maybe I'm just, I think he draws him in kind of a way that his face kind of looks like a Guy Fawkes mask.
Huh.
I just was like, huh.
Well, he does have a Van Dyke.
Yes, he does have the little goatee and everything, but there is just this one panel where the way his head was angled and the way his goatee and everything and what you could see of his face.
Okay.
So
interesting. What I like about the premise and the way it comes out in the story or is executed in the story is the word that I was looking for and I didn't find, and I'm adding to seem like I'm smart, but
I
couldn't find the word.
I understand.
It's on me. Is that it affects the story. It is the story, but it also affects the story. Like Sliders is the other thing that I mentioned before. Sliders is fine, but generally Sliders is just, oh, this week we're on a dinosaur planet. This week we're on the planet where the U.S. took over Britain instead of the other way around.
Right.
And immediately the fact of multiple alternate universes becomes part of the story, and that will continue. I have read past this point. It will continue. Where the group that we see, we're not going to recognize in 20 issues. You won't even recognize them anymore. Not to mention the main character is dead.
Right.
The information that he gets, that Kadir is the one that sabotaged the pillar, he gets from an alternate version of himself.
I know.
He would never have gotten that information. You know, Kadir might have gotten away or might have continued to try to sabotage or maybe kill Grant. He gets that information in a way that he shouldn't be able to. From another universe that information comes.
Yes.
And so that's cool. The fact that they carry things with them, like the energy thing is possessed, what's her name, and that's coming along.
Yes.
That shaman guy sticks around for a while.
I know. Oh,
they kidnap this robo shaman.
Yes.
And he kind of joins the party.
So he can fix Grant, the main character, who
and he hangs
later
out for
dies.
For a long time.
But okay, they show him just kind of sitting around on the Cantina planet, and then...
Cantina?
Cantina, sorry. And then, the next place... Where's the next place they jump to after that?
Don't they go to the planet where Grant attacks Kadir? The monkey planet?
Oh, is that the monkey planet?
I think so.
All right, I guess I didn't...
Oh, and... Sorry. And on the monkey planet, they find Grant Monkey. They find a monkey who is, it's heavily implied, is the alternate monkey universe version of Grant.
And there's another
and
pillar.
And Kadir cuts his head off.
Yep. And there is another pillar.
Which they break.
And the emblem that Jen created for their team
is being
seen
used. It's there.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of what is going on here?
There's an issue of, actually, Tom Strong... Often, sometimes they use the what's it called, the surfing the surfboard, the time travel and surfboard or whatever, and he uses it to go to other dimensions. There's an issue called the Many Lives or Worlds of Tesla Strong, where she uses it. She's not supposed to, because, you know, she's a 60-year-old kid.
Right.
And she runs into a bunch of other Tesla Strongs, and there's this whole, like, cross-dimensional caper type thing. This is like that in an ongoing series, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is, it's just, it's very entertaining, and it keeps you, the characters, you instantly care about them, and you want to know more about them. Although I have to say, it does make it very hard for me to really care about Grant. I know he cares about his kids, but
it's problematic. He's a problematic hero.
Yeah. It's hard to feel completely sympathetic about him.
Yep. Keep reading. Clearly, you would recommend this.
Yes, absolutely. I would recommend this. I would recommend this if you enjoy, you know, science fiction books. If you like stuff off the beaten path. If you're big on characters.
Although this is, it's like calling, I don't know, like a band that started off as being real underground that's now huge and everybody loves them. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're super underground.
We're super underground.
I don't know, like the Black Keys or something like that.
Right.
Oh, boy. Have you heard about this band? Yes, I have. I mean, this thing sold out. Everybody knows about Black Science. It's not.
Right.
It's not exactly an indie book.
No, it's not. Yeah. And it sold out of its like initial run. Right. Like from the source. Which
they did reprints.
That's crazy. Did they have any idea? They must not have known how popular it was going to be.
I think in comics, and don't quote me on this, but you want that. You want scarcity sometimes. You want money, clearly.
That's
very
true.
But you want, you know, if you can do a first print run that sells out, and then you can just reprint it and sell it for the same price, then you had a run on them, and there will be a run on the second ones because the first one sold out. So there is an awareness of the scarcity and the importance.
Right. No,
or something like that.
Yes.
I would recommend this too, for sure. Although I have fallen off, I am not up to date on the book itself. And that made researching it to talk about it a little scary because I didn't want any
plot points ruined. Spoilers.
But it's like the good parts of Lost. Like the fact that when you put it down, as soon as you see, like it's Lost.
Yes.
You just wish that you could sleep for 6 days and then see the next episode. And that's what Black Science is like for me. Like, you put it down, and you're immediately like, where's the next one?
Yeah.
Bring it on.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good way of putting it.
So,
get your little hands on it.
Get your little Black Science band hands on it.
Yes.
It's Black Science from Image Comics. You can find it. It's out there. Don't worry about it. I would say that it is on Comixology. That's how I read it digitally. I do have the issues around somewhere, but I thought, let's give it a try. So it is easily available there. And if you've got a full size like iPad or like a large Android tablet, it'd probably be best, but it looks fantastic on those. So check it out. Hey, next time on Comic Book Club, next Friday, a special treat. We are going to read The Uniques, Volume 1, collecting, I believe, the first four issues of Comfort, Love, and Adam Withers's saga. It's definitely, maybe you're four issues into a saga. It will definitely be a saga at some point. The story of some young superheroes in a world of superheroes called The Uniques. And we have an interview with Comfort and Adam as well that will accompany that. And it's a long interview. And when I say long, I mean like this is a feature-length interview.
Right.
So that is going to take up most of our show, I believe, next Friday. But we're going to read and review their comic book, talk to them. They are exciting creators, and they are fun people to talk to and very thoughtful about the industry. They have a lot of – they'd be good on this show. I wonder if they have a show.
I don't know.
They should have
a
podcast. They'd be real good at it because they have a lot of things to say and a lot of great points to make about comics and the world of the nerd in general. Exactly. So, The Uniques, Volume 1, next time on Comic Book Club.
Play this record as frequently as possible. Then, as it becomes easier for you, play the record once a day or as needed.
Feels good.
Yeah.
It feels good.
Cal's own personal like soundtrack.
Go watch that video on YouTube.
Oh, gosh.
Watch it.
I'm a little terrified.
You'll watch it for about 30 seconds and go, I'm good.
Okay.
It is.
Looking forward to that.
Extremely weird.
All right.
Sometimes you have an idea for a video. It's a thriller. A thriller night.
Thriller.
And you're going to... I mean, that's a bad example because it cost...
It's awesome.
Cost a lot. And it was like just, you know, the most orchestrated, you know, organized,
theatrical,
choreographed
video
ever. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Sometimes you have that. Sometimes you just get, you've got Big Papa. We're just going to... Biggie and, of course, Puffy are in a club and he's going to talk about... all the things he's going to do to you,
yep,
and how you love it that he's Big Papa or whatever. And you don't have to do much. He's just standing there.
Right.
Maybe he's sitting at a table or something. Fine. This is a video where it was clear, no idea. What's our idea? No idea. So it feels good. We know that it feels good. Let's do that thing, which is always the last refuge of we're out of ideas. We're going to film the band performing. So they're on a stage.
Oh, gosh.
But then that's not enough.
Oh, no.
Because Tony isn't quite electrifying enough, as if. So they have, like, these other characters come out and do, like, they have, like, these ladies come out and they're, like, singing. They're like, yeah, it feels good. But they've also got, like, these mean ladies in, like, mirrored sunglasses that are, like, the Secret Service or the cop ladies. And they're like, no, you can't dance and it doesn't feel good.
They're
like, what?
They're the fun wreckers or what have the
yeah, they're like the sensor
fun
police
suckers.
Or something.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't get it. So, if you're out there, audience, go watch Tony's video for "It Feels Good," and comment on our web zone about what exactly is going on.
Ugh.
That's my challenge this week.
All right.
That web zone, you're going to find it at justenoughtrope.com. Also on Twitter and Facebook, if you search for Just Enough Trope, you can find our social media outlets. Use them or lose them. Actually, they're not going to go anywhere. They'll still be there. We're also on iTunes. If you look up Just Enough Trope on iTunes, you can find our show page. While you're there, I hope that you will subscribe to the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to get it. As soon as it's ready,
yep,
it'll come right to you, all the news of the nerd, plus our great movie and comic book reviews and talking about things like Black Science Man.
What I gotta say, been on the tip of my tongue this entire time. Neil deGrasse Tyson. That's what they were looking up.
Oh no! Oh no! Do you think that's what it is?
I actually clicked on it and that is what it is.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
So somebody sees a GIF with like, ooh, we got a badass over here, and they're like,
The guy,
Blazer,
the science,
beard, Cosmos, Seth MacFarlane, Black Science Man.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Yep.
All right. Forget everything I said. Don't go to our web zones. drink Drano and meet
Stop.
Your maker. Well, if you choose not to do that, you can find us on iTunes. Give us a review while you're there, too. We love to hear what you think about the show, and we love to hear from the fans and find out how we're doing. And also, give us a rating when you're there. Super, super important. Mm-hmm. When you give us a high rating on iTunes, we're going to move up in those ranks, which means that we get to bring more to you and everybody gets what they want. So give us five fish ladies, dancing,
dancing
slave,
fish ladies.
Fish, yeah, oh. fish Leias, really.
I know, right?
Yeah.
That's actually exactly what I thought of. She's got the teeny tiny little bikini type thing suggested.
Right. And she's attended by frogs, where Jabba eats frogs in Return of the Jedi. So in Black Science, frogs eat you.
Ooh.
That's too confusing.
I think it might actually be a nod. I'm gonna choose that it is.
You can ask Mateo when you see him if you're brave enough.
Okay.
But I'm not. So just give us 5 stars instead. I appreciate that. We are going to come back on Monday with our Craft Disservices segment where we review the bad, good, bad movies of history.
Yep.
This time around in our sort of focus on writing and creating and storytelling, we are doing Delirious from 1991 starring John Candy about a soap writer who hits his head and ends up inside of his soap. How could you not like that? That sounds amazing. I believe it's in the mid-40s on Rotten Tomatoes, and so that's another borderline one, but yep. I remember it being funny. We'll talk about that. Of course, we got the Uniques on Friday for Comic Book Club. Whew! That's it. I'm full. Pushing back from the table, like I said, and I think we're going to wrap it up for tonight. I'm your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning.